America's Mayor Rudy Giuliani.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Governor. Thank you. Thank you, Governor. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much, Governor Perry. Thank you for your support, for your coming with us to Iowa. The governor was with us this morning in Washington and endorsed me, and he wanted to come here and talk to all of you and explain the reason for his endorsement. And I thank him very, very much. Texas is one of our biggest states. It has some of the big problems that we have to deal with in keeping this country moving forward. He's a terrific governor, and the very best support you can get are from people who are actually on the line doing the job of governing in a way that is fiscally conservative and is taking care of the safety and security of his people. So it's a real honor to me to have him with us. And when I finish speaking, he'll come up and answer some questions. If you want to find out about, if you want to find out about how to reform the legal system, do you think that in America, just let me ask you this question, do you think that in America we sue too much? Yeah. What do you think? Do you think we sue too much? Okay. There's the, you know, the case in Washington. I just came from Washington. I try not to stay in Washington for too long because I'm afraid it does something to your brain. I think it does. I actually think I lived there for a while, and I think you have to get out of there. Now, think about this case for a minute. There was this lawsuit in Washington, D.C., where a man sued for $54 million because the cleaning store that he went to lost his pants. Well, this must have been one heck of a pair of pants, right? For $54 million? In fact, as an ex-U.S. attorney, I keep wondering, what did he have in his pants? If it's worth $54 million. But he sued for $54 million. The case went to court. The case, I think, went to trial. And the guy lost. Well, this is not a joke to the people who had to defend that case. They were just regular people, had a cleaning store, mom and pop cleaning store, small business. You know how much money it cost them to defend the case? $100,000. That's a lot of money. I think that our legal system should protect people against abuse like that. I think that, for example, that man should now have to pay them $100,000. He should have to restore them to where they were before he abused them with that lawsuit. And I think we have to change our legal system to reduce the abuse that goes on with lawsuits. In Texas, what they did was they capped non-economic damages. Because a lot of the abuse comes about in these excessive exaggerations of damages, like that man did, right? The man actually had a valid claim, right? He had a claim for $100 or $200, I don't know, maybe $1,000. I have no idea what his pants cost. That he had a right to have the cleaning store pay him for the value of his pants, maybe pay him a teeny bit for the inconvenience that it caused, and he could go buy another pair of pants to replace that pair of pants. Instead, he sues for $54 million. So they capped any of these damages beyond economic loss at $250,000. They did a whole group of other things, too, to tighten up their legal system, to make it fairer. You know what happened the first year after they passed it? The number of doctors applying to practice medicine in Texas went up by 9%. The next year, it went up by 30%. If he keeps it up, we're going to all have to go to Texas for medical care. There aren't going to be any doctors left. They're all going to go to Texas. I mean, women in this country, in many parts of this country, complain to me that they can't find an OBGYN. They say doctors are going out of that area of the profession because that area of the profession has so many lawsuits and malpractice insurance is so high. Well, this issue of suing too much affects our health care. It makes it much more expensive for all of us. It affects the quality of our health care. It affects the doctors that we have, the availability, our access to health care. And then it affects our economy too. We don't see that as much, we don't feel that as much, but I can guarantee you it's happening. Countries that sue too much lose businesses. They lose jobs. There are four big things you have to be careful of in our economy. And if these things are happening, your economy shrinks and Americans have less jobs. If you can reverse these four things and prevent them from happening, then your economy grows and the sky's the limit. Here are the four things: overspending, overregulating, overtaxing, and oversuing. You do all those things too much, or any one of them too much, and your economy shrinks. It literally puts a lid on your economy, and people can't grow, and young people don't have as bright a future when there's a lid on your economy. Now, if you make sure that those four things don't happen, if you're a president that understands that this economy is essentially a private economy that needs to be encouraged, not burdened, then you kind of lift that lid off, and people can aim for the sky. They can become as successful as their hard work and talent and sometimes luck allows them to be. And what happens in an America that is organized around that kind of principle is that helps all of us. Somebody starts a business, that's good for them. It's also good for the two people they hire. And that business can expand. It's good for them, and it's good for the 10 people they can now hire. And that business expands more. Now they hire 1,000 people. Some people get very jealous. Well, that guy with the business with 1,000 is getting very rich. I mean, he's getting, the way I look at it, now 1,000 people are working. And 2,000. This is the way America grows. This is the quintessential thing about our country. We're a private enterprise country. We're not a big central government country. Or at least, when we're a private enterprise country, we grow. Sky's the limit. When we're too much of a centralized government country, we become like Europe. So, here's what I would do. I would, first of all, make sure that we kept taxes low and lowered them some more. Since you put some Democrats in Congress, for example, here in Iowa, they voted to raise your taxes. It's a mistake to raise taxes in the present economy that we have. A big mistake. It is not going to help poor people. It's going to hurt poor people. I tell you that as an expert, as someone who had a city that was dramatically hurting poor people by taxing too much, because we were taxing jobs out of the city of New York. I lowered taxes. I lowered taxes in New York City. No mayor before me had ever lowered taxes in a systematic way like I did. It was a real battle to get New York City to lower taxes. I lowered taxes 23 times by over $9 billion. I reduced the income tax in New York City by 24%. I was collecting 40% more from the lower tax than the higher tax. I was collecting billions of dollars more from the lower taxes than the higher taxes. And let me tell you what happened to unemployment. I started and unemployment was 10.5%. When I left, it was about 5%. You know how many more people were working? You know how many more people had jobs? You know how many more people had improved jobs? That's how you do the magic, because to some people who don't understand private sector economics, they think this is impossible. That's how you accomplish lowering taxes and collecting more money. How can you lower tax rates and collect more money? You do that because more people are working, because more people are making more money by a lot. I took over a city that lost 320,000 jobs. I left a city that had 457,000 new jobs. And it came about with growth economics, the core of it being lowering taxes. If we want our economy to grow, we have to continue to do that. We've got to keep the income tax rate low. We've got to keep the capital gains tax low. We've got to give the death penalty to the death tax, which means we've got to get rid of it. These are all things that hold our economy down. In the name of wanting to redistribute wealth, they hold our economy down because they keep reducing it to the lowest common denominator. If you lower taxes, put more money back into the private economy, you lift that lid, and then people can grow to their maximum extent. And they grow, other people grow with them. Same thing is true about spending. You've got to get control of government spending. If government spends too much money, then government has to feels the impulse to tax more. As it taxes more, it reduces the economy. And the government spending is often inefficient. By and large, if the private sector can spend money on the same thing that the government spends money on, the private sector will spend it 2, 3, 4 times more efficiently than government. Because there's no device for wanting to save money in government. In the private sector, there's a device for saving money. It's called profit. In government, there's very often no device for saving money. That's why the worst thing we could do for healthcare, the worst thing we could do for healthcare is to add more people to the government rolls. More people covered by government, the more expensive healthcare will be. If you want to give access to more people for healthcare, and you want to bring the cost of healthcare down, and you want to bring the quality of healthcare up, the last thing in the world you do is create a government mandate and a government program. Here's what happens with government mandates and government programs. It becomes more, the minute the government mandates something, it becomes more expensive. The minute people who supply things know you have to have it, the price goes up and the quality goes down. They can ask for more money for less. How can you perform the following task? Reduce cost, increase quality. The answer for healthcare is the same as it is for retail products or anything else. A large consumer market where people have power and the ability to buy things. So the best way to straighten out healthcare in this country is to totally change our tax system and make it very, very enticing, very desirable for people to buy their own health insurance. And the more people we can encourage to buy their own health insurance, by every single additional person that we encourage to buy their own, the price of health insurance will start to come down. If we give people a $15,000 tax exemption, if we allow them to have health savings accounts, we can take the number of people who have their own health insurance from 17 million to 50 million. And that progression will do miracles for health care. All of a sudden, you'll see the cost of health insurance go down by 10%, 20%, 50%. You'll eventually see it get cut in half. And you'll see the quality increase. Isn't that what happens with retail products? I'll tell you a little story about, do you know the iPhone? Any of you have an iPhone? You got an iPhone? There you go. He's got an iPhone. Can I show you an iPhone? Not that I know how to operate. I'm not going to talk on the cell phone. I'm just going to show it to you. There's an iPhone. Okay. This came out about 4 months ago, 5 months ago, right? Back like in June or something, May or June. I was at a friend's house, and he has two youngsters, probably about college age, about somewhere between like 19 and 21. One of them had bought the iPhone, and the other didn't. And the one who bought the iPhone was trying to, was a little complicated at first to program it, I guess. Not that bad, I know, but for me, it's like calculus, you know. But he was showing me how he was programming it. And all the stuff, all I was interested in is, can you see baseball games on it? When he told me no, I wasn't that interested anymore. But he was showing me how to program it. The other kid was sitting there and he's like reading a book. And I said, how come, I said to the youngster who didn't have it, I said, how come you don't have an iPhone? And you know what he said to me? I'm going to wait until it's half price. So I said to the one, I said, the kid who was working on the iPhone, I said, you're going to be a really good computer technologist. And I pointed to the kid who said it's going to be half price. I said, you're going to be a billionaire. He just got it. Democratic candidates for president don't get it. They don't get it. He got it. That's how you reduce price. And the iPhone now is $200 less than when it first came out, right? I thought it went from $599 to $399. $499 to $399. Well, he's not going to buy it until it gets down to like $200, I think. But it will. It'll get down to $200. And probably when it gets down there, it'll have even more features. Why? How does that happen? How could that miracle happen? How could the iPhone go down 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%? How? And quality stays the same or goes up. Because millions of people are buying it. So you've got to get millions of people to buy health insurance. And you got to give them a tax incentive to do it and a health savings account and give these young people equity in their... That's how we'll save health care. It's the American way to save it. Not the European way to save it. I mean, if we do Hillary care in this country, where are the Canadians going to go for health care? They'll have to go to Texas. They're the only place left. They're the only place left. Finally, we also have to make sure that we keep regulations sensible. I know it sounds fine to regulate, but we can't regulate businesses out of existence. To understand the interplay between government and business is to understand how to create jobs for people. I did it. The difference between me and the Democratic candidates is I've actually run something. I mean, they've never run anything. Did you ever think about that? Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards. They've never run a city like I did. They never run a state like Governor Perry is doing. I don't think they've ever run a big business of any kind. They've never had to make payrolls, never had to pay taxes for other people, make sure they were paid. They never had to do budgets. They never had to think of the practical implications of what they're saying. You can just promise anything, say anything. It's important to have that experience. It's important to have that experience because you learn you can't promise all things to all people. You can't one day promise them baby bonds for $22 billion, which Hillary promised about a week ago. She's going to give out baby bonds to everybody born in the country. They're going to get $5,000. You're just going to get sent to you a nice baby bond. It could cost about $21 billion. See, when I say that, it all of a sudden, the practicality of it starts to enter in. Maybe I immediately think of the practicality because I ran something. And it's going to cost more than $21 billion because somebody's going to have to print it. You've got to pay them for that. Somebody's going to have to put Hillary's picture on it. You're going to have to pay them for that. And somebody's got to mail it. And post office wants a little money, you know. It starts to add up now. And this isn't Hillary's money, it's yours. So Hillary backed off that, and now she's got another one where she's going to give you $1,000 for a 401k, and I'm losing track now of all the promises of spending your money. All kinds of money is going to be coming from Washington if Hillary is president. The problem with all kinds of money coming from Washington is it's your money. And it just gets recirculated through Washington. And Washington takes like a 30-40% discount, and it gets to be a lot more expensive. And our whole economy then gets pushed in the tank. So I can sum it up this way. There's a book by the new president of France called Testimony. You should read the book because it outlines a really sensible economic program. President of France, the new president of France, wants to do the following. He wants to reduce the corporate tax rate in France because it's too high. And he's afraid he's losing businesses to other countries because his corporate tax rate is too high, that the French are losing jobs. Well, his corporate tax rate is less than America's. He wants to reduce the income taxes. He wants to do away with the inheritance tax, or at least reduce it, because he sees the French taking their wealth, the wealthy ones, taking their wealth and moving it to England. And therefore, France doesn't get the benefit of that wealth. He wants to give people school choice. Wants to give parents what we call vouchers so they can pick the school of their choice, private, parochial, public, charter. And he wants to get the French to work more than 35 hours a week. That's good, right? And he's going to give them tax-free money to do it. Okay, these are all American reforms. This is like totally contrary to the centralized socialistic ideas they had in France for a long time that's holding them back. So I've been having this dream lately. It goes something like this. He's on an airplane, Sarkozy's on an airplane going from France to the United States. He's about halfway over the Atlantic. And this other airplane is coming right up toward his airplane, and they almost hit. And they get so close, you can look inside the window of the other plane. And he recognizes the three people in the plane going from the United States to France. And he waves to them very politely, and they wave to him very enthusiastically. And in the other plane, going to France, are Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John Edwards. They're all going to France. They're all going to France to figure out how they can get all of these failed policies from France. And let's see if we can inflict them on the American people. higher taxes, more government control of health, more government control of education, more government control of who knows what, the air that you breathe. I mean, all these things are failure. The whole world is going in the other direction. The whole world is going in the direction of bigger free markets, more free trade, lower taxes, smaller central government, and we got three candidates for president that are going in exactly the opposite direction. If we're not careful, if you don't elect me, this country could be to the left of France. And that's why I'm running, because I understand how to keep this government fiscally conservative, which means a growing economy for you, particularly for young people. These policies sound good, and they are extremely damaging. They sound very enticing. We'll send you money. We'll guarantee your health care. We'll take care of you from cradle to grave. We'll send you money when you get born. Problem with that is, that's the last time you get any money from Washington. The rest of it you got to earn. And you got to grow up in a society that supports your ability to earn money, your ability to work for yourself and take care of yourself. That's a growth society. That's what's made us unusual, not these policies the Democrats are talking about. So these are the reasons that I'm running, in addition to one that I haven't mentioned that you can ask me about, and it's the most important, to keep us on offense against Islamic terrorism. America has to be on offense. We cannot go back to the defense that the Democrats want to play against Islamic terrorism. So, why don't you ask me questions, or if you have questions for Governor Perry, he would be happy to answer it, and we'll start with somebody back here, and then we'll go around this way. Anybody back here? Yes.
Mr. Mayor, I've been following Congress, and they're putting forth a resolution, I believe, in the House to resurrect the Armenian-Turkish crisis, certainly during the Ottoman Empire. And what is your view of what they're trying to do in the House?
My view is that if you're asking for an accurate statement of history, it's correct. But that probably wisdom would say that right now you wouldn't do it. Now, and I think they are. I think they recognized that this isn't the right time to do that. And I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's going to stay where it is. The subcommittee voted for it. They made the point. If you ask me, is it a historically correct point? Yes, it is. But is this the right time to make it? It appears when you listen to what General Petraeus has to say and Ambassador Crocker and everyone else, this would not be the most sensible time to make it, and I think this was just a mistake. To do it now. The resolution itself is accurate, but to do it right now is not the right time to do it, and I think that's probably how it's all going to come out.
I'm kind of interested in Iowa not be a red state or a green state, or a blue state, but be a green state. Could you tell me a little bit, most of our electricity is produced by coal in this country, and could you tell us a little bit about your thoughts about electricity and coal in general?
Sure. I think it should be a green state too. I think of a green state as being an environmentally sound state, a healthy state, a safe state, and a state with a lot of money. Because when I think of green, I think of all you people being able to earn a lot of money, which is a good thing. I think that there is a very, very promising, not more than promising, a developed technology that could really allow us to use our coal and use it safely without contributing unnecessarily to pollution or global warming, and that's carbon sequestration, cleaning coal. It's expensive. Right now it's expensive. All emerging new technologies are right now, at the beginning, expensive. The government should help with that. I don't think the government should be in the business of subsidizing for long periods of time, but I think the government should be in the business of even subsidizing in a situation in which an industry is emerging, it's in the national interest, it maybe is even a national security issue, and the government should try to help that industry emerge into a full-fledged process. We have more coal reserves in the United States than they have oil reserves in Saudi Arabia. And if we can rely on those coal reserves in a way that doesn't harm the environment, in a way that's consistent with a clean environment, we're going to be in a much better position. And whenever I talk about energy independence, I think of it as a threefer. You know, you've heard of twofer, threefer, three benefits in one. Whenever I say energy independence or any of these technologies that leads to energy independence, please think of the following. It, in most cases like this, it reduces pollution and the impact on global warming. Number two, right now, it's a national security matter. The more we can have independence, the more pressure we can put on those governments that are dangerous in part because they have so much energy that they're selling. And third, it's a great business for us. It's a great business for us to readdress the balance of trade. When you think that our balance of trade is off, right, we're importing too much and we're exporting too little, there are two approaches to this. One approach is the Democrats' approach, which is largely becoming stop importing. Very, very strange, by the way. Bill Clinton is one of the presidents that kind of opened up free trade. Now the Democrats want to go back to stop importing. We have to make sure that imports are safe. We have to make sure that we're properly protected. All that's correct. But we have to be in favor of being able to buy from foreign countries. It helps our economy. Here's what we should think about. Here's the opposite thing to think about when you say, how do you redress the imbalance in trade? One group says, stop the imports. I say, increase the exports. Sell more. That'll make us a growing economy. The other is going to make us decline. We're going to be perpetuating our inefficiencies, and we will decline. We will grow if we sell more. What can we sell? Energy independence. China needs energy independence. India needs energy independence, energy alternatives. If we need clean coal, they need clean coal four times more than we do. If we need to license more nuclear power, they need to license more nuclear power. China's going to build 40 nuclear power plants. We should be building it for them. We invented it. We invented the peaceful use of nuclear power. We do it best. But we haven't licensed a nuclear power plant in 30 years because we're on hold. So when you think all of this energy independence, whether it's biofuels like here in Iowa, or it's clean coal or wind, I visited a really very, very impressive wind turbine factory here in Iowa. You know what I was impressed with the wind turbines? They sell for $2.5 million. I was thinking, you sell a couple of those to China, it makes up for a lot of the stuff we buy from them. $2.5 million is a lot of money. You are building here in Iowa wind turbines for my home state of New York. They're going to put them in Buffalo, New York. It helps. Every little bit helps. Look at it this way. There's no magic solution to energy independence. There's no one big technology. It can't be all clean coal. It can't be all nuclear. It can't be all biofuels. It can't be all wind, solar, hydropower. It can't be all conservation. We can do more conservation, but we're not going to be able to create energy independence. We'd have to stop using energy if we were going to do it that way. But think of it this way. Each one of these things helps. Each one of these things, if you grow it, reduces your reliance on foreign oil by 5%, 10%, 15%. You start multiplying that out by 8 or 9 or 10 different new technologies, and now all of a sudden you've become energy diversified, energy independent. And had we done this 30 years ago, I can't say for sure, but I'm not sure we would be in quite the predicament we are in with Islamic terrorism, and at least the funding of it, because we would have a lot more leverage. We would find that right now, I think the president of Russia is in Iran. I think it's right now, or he was going there. Do you think if we could cut off Iran as a supplier of oil, do you think the president of Russia would be there? I don't know, maybe, but probably not. And Iran would mean a lot less if we could isolate them, if we could present to other countries opportunities other than using Iranian oil. And we've got to have that flexibility in the future. That's why it's a matter of national, when I say it's a matter of national security, energy independence is one of the ways, just one, but one of the ways to win the war on terror or the terrorist war against us. We won the Second World War by our industry to a large extent, by the bravery of our men and women that Rick and I were talking about earlier, but also by the people at home who built the biggest army, navy, and air force in the world in 2 years. Well, we can give ourselves a real boost in this war on terror if we have energy independence. Yes, sir.
I'm a college student working with ARP, and we're working on our next campaign called The Light of Detail. Do you think many
young people in America have no information or education on how to manage their finances? What would your administration do to increase the financial literacy of the next generation? And also, we're still hoping that you can join us in Sioux City next week for our The Why Did We Fail forum.
Well, first of all, on the various forums and debates, where because there are so many, you end up insulting more people than you really intend to. I've been invited to like a dozen debates, sometimes on the same day, and you just can't do them all. You just can't. We've tried to have a rule of one per month, and the first one we accept, then we've got to say no to all the rest. Because if I go to all the debates, I can't run my campaign. I can't raise the ridiculously large amount of money that you need to run a presidential campaign, which I would love if it were different, but it isn't. And then you can't be in the places you need to be to make the political points that you want to make. So if we said no to it, it's not at all, it has to do with your organization. It has to do with the fact that we already agreed to a debate, and therefore we're going to kind of limit ourselves to one. Maybe we'll stretch it as we get along to two a month. But if we do anything else, we'll run out of our ability to run this. Now, you want to know about financial literacy, people learning more about our economy. I think economics, you know, is a major topic. And by and large, it should be taught at a much earlier stage. You know, economics 101 is a college course. Economics 101 should be taught in high school. And a lot of high schools are doing it now. But you should teach economics at a much earlier stage. Because some of the misconceptions that politicians create in your mind comes from the fact that sometimes people don't know basic economics, and then the politicians spin them all around. And basic understanding of supply and demand, the interplay between a government economy and a private economy, the different models that we have throughout the world of centralized economies, more diversified economies, which ones work. Read Greenspan's book. No, read it. I mean, some of the criticisms that I don't agree with, some I do agree with, but read it. If I were teaching in Economics 101, I'd have my class read Greenspan's Age of Turbulence. I'm not going to get a royalty from that plug. That would be against the conflict of interest rules. Yes, sir.
Hello, thank you. Dr. Alan Koslow, I'm the president of the state chapter of the American Diabetes Association. And first I'd like to see how many people here is healthcare and healthcare for all a very high priority for them? Okay, first off, I want to compliment you on your statement in your position of principles on your website about healthcare, except for the aspect of healthcare for all. With your plan, if someone is making $30,000, $40,000 a year, they're only paying $3,000 or $4,000 in taxes, and health care costs $10,000. What I'm asking you to do is just make one simple thing, add two words to your statement of principles on health care, for all. Right in the middle, before you talk about the problem, and about the second line, if you add the words for all, and you stick to that and make a commitment to do that, because just tax credits won't do it.
Well,
thank you.
First of all, health care should be accessible for all. The problem with that is should the government guarantee health care for all? And if the government guarantees health care for all, we will never be able to reduce the cost of health care and make it accessible to people. And we will diminish dramatically the quality of health care. So I am...
Let me finish. People go to emergency rooms and get hospitalized.
Let me finish the thought, because it's a complex thought. The reality is that that is a nice promise to make, but you'll be misleading people. We will be leading them into a deteriorated healthcare system. What we should be doing, how do the people that earn $30,000 or $40,000, how are they able to afford a television? There are a lot of people that earn $30,000 or $40,000 that have a television, right? How do they afford a television? Because the television has become so cheap. That's why. Because the price of televisions has come down dramatically. How do people that earn $40,000 or $50,000 afford a cell phone? Because cell phone companies are virtually giving away cell phones now because they've become so cheap. Well, that's what has to happen. You've got to get those forces operating in our healthcare economy or our healthcare economy is doomed. You have got to get the cost of healthcare down. Now, why does the tax credit work? Or the tax, it's not a tax credit. And I would consider tax credits for those people at 30 and 40,000, which means it would give them a little money to be able to buy it. But I would do that as the market started to shift. The people who can't afford health care right now are not the poorest people. The poorest people have Medicaid. Then above the group that don't have health care are the people that can afford it. Either their employer supplies it or they can buy it. So you've got these people in a gap, right? About 45 to 47 million people estimated. These people are not the poorest. All of these people, or most of them, are consumers, meaning they buy things. They're not incapable of buying things. But they don't buy health insurance for two reasons. Because health insurance is too expensive, and because they don't see the gain in buying health insurance. If you drove down the price of health, if you could magically drive down the price of health insurance to a couple of $1,000s a year, or $3,000 a year, and you could create tax incentive and even tax credits to help them bridge the gap, they would be able to buy health insurance. If you showed them that they could actually gain equity if they started at a young age buying health insurance, maybe the young people who aren't buying health insurance right now, who actually can afford it, but they take the risk because they're young and healthy, and we all think we're immortal when we're young, right? They would buy health insurance. We've got to get a complex, big, gigantic market going that will drive the price down. It will give everyone access to health insurance. And then if there are some people left that don't have access, that would be the people we could help with tax credits, which means money. Tax exemptions means exemptions from your tax return. But actual monetary help in buying your own health insurance would be something we could do if we got the gap down and we could bridge it correctly. So I would not add that way because it's an oversimplified statement. I would say my objective is to make healthcare accessible for everyone. Maybe we'll put it that way.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor, you only have time for one more question.
Okay. So let's go. I'm going to take one question from the left. Got anybody over here that wants to ask a question? This lady right there? Okay.
Global epidemic?
Yes, I think that fighting HIV/AIDS is one of the most important things we can do. First of all, it's one of the most humanitarian important things we can do. And secondly, I think it's one of the ways in which America can and has, in fact, been able to show a different face. I think this is one of the things that President Bush has been very good about. And I think it's something that, unfortunately, maybe it's the idea of being a second-term president, or maybe it's the media biases, or I don't know what it is, but President Bush doesn't get credit for the good things that he does. He has put more money into this and fighting it in Africa than any president. He wants to put more into it, and I would support that, and I would look for ways not only to be more supportive, but to get other countries to help us. I think it's as a matter of conscience, it's something we have to do. But as a matter of good politics and good diplomacy, it's a wonderful thing to do. It has America, which sometimes looks too militaristic. It shows what the American soul and the American heart is really all about. Now, I don't believe America is really too militaristic. I think we're painted that way. So this gives us a way to show what America is really all about, what we really desire. What we really desire is a healthy world, a world in which people have freedom, a world in which people have decent rights and human rights, and a world where we can be peaceful. We just recognize that the stage we're at in this world, in order to get there, we have to be militarily strong. And we're going to dissuade people from harming us. But I think funding AIDS, help, assistance, HIV, AIDS, all of these programs, private programs, does anybody here represent the one program? Let me see. I thought I saw that. I got to put my glasses on. Well, you're doing great work. I met with Bono and your leader, and I'm very familiar with it. You're doing absolutely terrific work. You do terrific work because you get Republicans and Democrats to agree on something. That's great. And we're really not enemies. Republicans and Democrats are really not. I mean, we agree on more things than we disagree on. And the things that we disagree on are honest policy differences. They're not personal. I have very strong views on the economy and on taxes. But I don't get personally angry at somebody who disagrees with me on taxes. You know, I mean, we've been having these disagreements from the beginning of the Republic. You know, Hamilton and Jefferson had these disagreements about a strong central government and a more diversified federal system of government. And maybe we're not so bad. At least we're not doing what Burr and Hamilton did, which is to shoot at each other. So it might not be as might be kind of instinctive in how strongly we feel about things. But you are bridging a gap, and I don't think there's any disagreement between Republicans and Democrats on the fact that we should be in a constructive way funding treatment, cure, assistance. One of the things that we can do that is really constructive with Africa and the Middle East is to trade more with them. Because if we can trade more with a country, it's like the wisdom we got to on welfare. You know, we did welfare for such a long time, we were making people dependent. We were just giving a hand out. And then we figured out by encouraging work and we could have a hand up. The same thing is true with trade. Trading with Africa, trading with the Middle East, trading with South America. And that's the spirit in which I believe in free trade. There are three agreements right now in front of Congress to open up more trade with Panama, with Peru, and Colombia. We should do that. The more we trade with Panama, Peru, and Colombia, the more we keep them away from Chavez, the more we keep them rooted in a free market economy, the more we're able to export, and the more we can accomplish what I said, sell more to these countries. I think we should look for considerably more trade with Africa as well. Well, thank you very, very much. Always, as always, great question. Thank you. Thank you.